everybody. This is March Twisdale. I'd like to welcome you to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. You're listening to Voice of Vashon, webcast in real time at voiceofvashon.org, also available on archive and broadcast on Comcast Channel 21. Today I'm sitting at my kitchen table with Holland Kane, author of two published books. We have Winter Reads, which came out first, Morning Light, the one we'll talk about today, and a third one is on the way. Thank you for taking the time to talk with me.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. It's such a pleasure.
I'm glad you guys got to play at the farmer's market, too, and really enjoy Vashon.
It was wonderful.
Yay. Okie doke. So as a reminder to our listeners, Prose, Poetry, and Purpose is where authors get a chance to share and discuss the social underpinnings of their work, the hopes, as it were, that they have for their readers, which brings us to your most recently published novel, Morning Light. Okie doke. So, Holland, you told me that Morning Light took you a lot longer to write than Winter Reads and apparently Deer Creek, the next book on the way. How much longer, and why do you think that was?
There were several reasons. It was a difficult issue to deal with. I was raised in a profoundly religious family, and I'm grateful actually for the moral basis that they have provided. But there are so many problematic issues in a contemporary life, and some of my views have changed in the course of 10 years, which was part of the reason that it took a long time to write the book.
How many revisions did this book go through, do you think? Should I even ask?
Well, a dozen minimum, maybe 20.
Yeah. Sometimes people will say to me, aren't you done with that book yet? I want to read it now. And I'm like, oh my gosh. Okay. So, as you said, this novel, which I really enjoyed reading, and I could imagine, wow. I mean, your brother, I believe, he had already passed by the time the book came out?
Yes, but that was fairly recent, 2 years ago.
But he also helped you with the book. I mean, this novel, didn't you say, I think that you researched it heavily with his help?
Yes.
Do you want to tell us about your brother a little bit?
But I don't want to be misleading in that sense. My brother is a profoundly pious and serene man. Mm-hmm. He had chosen to give up a prosperous life as an electrical engineer with a master's degree. He was working for aerospace company, went back into Rome and became a priest after years of study. And then rather than being one of the diocesan priests, he chose the relative poverty by becoming a missionary priest in Brazil, where I gather one time his life was actually threatened because of his ability to always point his fingers at some problematic issues in society. And then he ended up being a priest in a poor parish in Mexico City for about 25 years.
Wow.
And I visited him there several times.
Right. So it's interesting. He did through his faith, it sounds like, he also was reaching out, the social underpinnings of his faith and of his work. And then you're here with your novel. And I just love talking with people who in blend their life with the world. And it's not just about themselves, but about their impact on the world around them and how they're able to contribute. So.
Well, my brother certainly did. I mean, he was admirable in many respects. I wouldn't say the same thing about myself.
Okay, now this is so cute. So the chickens are coming into the house. These are the baby chickens. You might be able to hear them. We'll pick them up a little bit on the radio. They were born in the house.
I hope they're readers.
Right. They were born in the house. We have a house chicken and then they got used to being here, so they run up into the house every once in a while and they get water and they go out on the porch.
That one is gorgeous.
Hey, girls.
Salt and pepper.
Hey, girls.
Very stylish chickens.
Yeah, let me give them their water. I think they'll go back out on the porch. Come here, girls. You're here for water. There you go. Go on, girls. Obviously, I'll be editing this out. That's a good girl. Okay. Good girls. Okay. Alrighty. So, Holland. Oh, wow. So, Holland, you set out to write a novel. Surely you came across the sage advice against lecturing people in a novel. When we write a novel, it needs to be story first. And your book, I think, does a really great job of being story first. But at the same time, you're definitely making social commentary. I mean, you have something to say. And I'm just wondering, as an author, how you grappled with, I've got these things I want to say that are sort of serious and real world, but I want to do it in a fictional novel. And I'm wondering how you blended those two goals.
The stronger your opinions are, the more difficult it is. And it just takes lots of rewriting and thinking about it and saying, look, I'm here to both inform and entertain and readers, mainly engage readers. You need that editor. You need to put away, you need somebody else perhaps also reading your work and telling you, you know, this is needs an adjustment or whatever. And so it's not that there's any magic. There's just an awful amount of work.
Yeah, no kidding. The amount of work. I have so much respect as I try to write a novel myself for what goes into this. So I'm thinking that part of how you managed this was you used two constructs. One is the looking back in time piece. So your narrator, I'm going to ask you to tell us a little bit about him. He is looking back in time, which of course gives you the power as an author to have him sort of know things that he might not have otherwise known. Then you have the insights that are provided by Emily's diary. So if you could tell us a little bit about your narrator and about Emily and about how you use those two constructs, I think, so effectively to allow yourself to reach the goal that you had.
Well, it's just a wonderful inspiration to be inspired by other writers. And I was thinking of Pirandello's six characters in search of an author, and which broke the barriers of theater. And then certainly Our Town, which is referenced in the novel. And thinking about the other people who created these narratives, I needed something that would go beyond the conventional sense of having chapters separated by character, mm-hmm. or having it told only by the first person, and I mm-hmm. needed to have the voice of Emily, the dancer.
It's remarkable. You have her voice and mm. you have David's voice. You have both of them in there, and. Mm. You know, a lot of people don't feel like the only way they see they can do it sometimes is you switch chapters, right? But you, it's like, I really like the seamlessness of how the lack of switching chapters really made it feel more organic and more real, I think, instead of, you know, sort of forced.
Well, thank you. I mean, first, by the way, it was written in the first person at one time, and then it was written in the third person at another time. So it ended up, you know, and I don't want to get into technical stuff like that, but the in the process of revision, finally there ends up being a sensibility in one's head that you go with, and mm-hmm. eventually some people respond to it and others perhaps not.
Right. So I believe you are planning to read for us, which is exciting. You will be reading from Morning Light, which is the most recently published book. And in a moment after you read, we're going to talk a little bit about relevancy, because that is that's something I love to talk to my authors about. And you want to go for
it? That sounds like a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah.
Again, thank you for this opportunity.
Oh, it's a blast.
I'm going to read actually from the very beginning of the book, because mm-hmm. that's what I hope will engage everyone into the story. In the spring of the year that Emily's husband told her his religion barred him from sleeping with her unless she quit using birth control, the crocuses and the hyacinth had already bloomed, and I was living in a house in Brooklyn. The startling development in an otherwise warm marriage upset her. She wasn't opposed to having children, but at her age, she was nowhere near the dreaded advanced maternal age, code AMA, that some nurses posted on the doors of delivery rooms, and she expected to wait several more years before starting a family. She recorded the date they stopped having sex in her journal on her 24th birthday. Rick's abstinence, he was a Roman Catholic, seemed to alter the location of the Earth's gravity. She was mystified how his faith could suddenly turn her into a source of sin. She blamed their recent personal bankruptcy and the collapse of his career for his sudden charismatic return to the solace of his religion. I was too young at the time to understand the events unfolding before me. I did not know at the time that Rick was denying himself the physical intimacy of sex with the only woman who had ever mattered to him, nor could I fathom the depth of Emily's frustration. She wrote in her journal that an element of shame entered her life, something she had never experienced before, the shame of thwarted intimacy, the shame of being spurned. And in the midst of this shame, my mother's friendship became all the more important to her. Emily wrote in her journal that Sarah became as vital as air, as essential as breathing. My mother became the North Star guiding Emily's uncharted American life. Sarah was an artist who'd always wanted to have a daughter, but she had only me, a boy. When she first met Emily, a dancer and choreographer, at the time only a 16-year-old Lithuanian immigrant girl, brought to the States illegally to work as household help, Sarah knew in her heart that she had found the daughter she had always wanted, and Emily found the mother she needed. The years went on, Emily's first boyfriend and breakup, and then her marriage to Rick. My mother and Emily discussed everything, made and changed plans, each advising the other and weighing a multitude of small decisions. Their attraction for each other could only be described as love. This affectionate relationship suffered in the last year of my mother's life, in part due to her declining health, but also due to Emily's self-censorship. She could not reveal to my mother the secrets she examined daily in her journals. In the same year that Rick doubled down on his resolve to remain true to his church's teachings, Emily was invited to perform to Jacob's Pillow Dance Festival. This was a huge breakthrough for her as a choreographer, a chance to dance before large audiences and meet the best performers in her field. She liked to choreograph opposing moods and then arrange these moods into movements. A pattern that was both simple and pleasing to audiences, a contest between clearly defined opposites, good and evil, love and loss, trial and testing, a pattern used since epic stories from the past. But who or what could have been the antagonist to take down her good marriage? Rick was neither a tyrant nor stupid. He loved her and continued to love her. The loyalist in her corner, an honorable man who had become unbending in his newfound principles. She saw his good qualities, and she loved him, too. But months into his abstinence, willy-nilly, she found herself attracted to me, then a 17-year-old boy.
And, wow, you've definitely presented us with a, looks like we have a conundrum coming.
Well, novels are made of conflict,
absolutely,
as perhaps most of our lives are made the same way.
Well, talk about relevancy.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, who could read this novel and not find something that they can really connect with or relate to?
Well, that's every writer's hope.
Yeah. So... thank you very much for reading that. And, I mean, I want you to keep going because I'm just like, whoo, but I've read the book. Everyone else will just need to pick up the novel if they want to read more of it. So let's talk a little bit then about relevancy. Authors always hope for relevancy, right?
Yes.
I guess what would be the point of, if you're writing a novel about something that's completely irrelevant to a particular reader, that reader probably will not stick with the story. And so I think a variety of relevant points, you know, the broader the appeal, you know. But what's really interesting about this book, which you started writing 10 years ago, 10 years prior to its publishing in 2012, so we're looking at 11 years ago, is that you couldn't have predicted at that time that right now, basically, it's a big hot topic, the involvement of, it happens to be the Catholic Church, with the lives of all sorts of people who are not followers of their faith, but who happen to live in our state, on our island, in our nation, and need access to medical care that is coming under the control and management of the Catholic Church. So what I find interesting is that the role of religion in marriage could have been about, you know, characters living in the Middle Ages or in the Old Kingdom of Egypt or in ancient Rome. I mean, that's an issue that happens all over the world and always has happened. But does it surprise you at all that right now in the modern day that we're seeing the same theme so vitally alive and active in our lives right now?
Well, it doesn't surprise me, but what it did, it encouraged me to write this book. Because I see the gender determinism that really is a premise that's completely outdated and historically questionable to begin with. Even the churches had many women participants, but then it became the Catholicism, especially, became male dominated, and only men participated, and it's part of the Judeo-Christian tradition also,
right,
to tell you the truth. But
right,
but it, the rules started changing. They simply kept women in a kind of mental creation of their own that isn't the woman's creation, mm-hmm, so to speak. So it's the cultural conflict that attracted me to this, and I don't think it's going to die anytime soon, and it may be with us, unfortunately, 50 years from now
or longer. Yeah, it occurred to me recently, you know, some of these religious institutions have been around for many, many thousands of years, and society has ebbed and flowed and come and gone, and yet, you know, the faith is consistently there. So these issues we're tackling are not something that's just going to be resolved, you know, with a couple of elections bit of public education. Or, I mean, you know, these are deep issues.
And I think it's so wonderful that this country has been created with a specific knowledge that the government will not either support or deny its citizens the right to form religions and believe in one or another, mm-hmm, that somehow they will try to keep a level platform for people to respond to community life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, now that brings me back to a little bit more information about your background. Your brother was definitely influential in your life and thus in your novel. But there's also your family history. You are from Lithuania, yes?
Yes, so English is my second language.
Right. So how was it writing about Emily's experience? How did your background play into that?
Well, it informs us in a sense that that immigrant background is an underprivileged background culturally. It's a background that struggles to understand. It doesn't know how to dress, how to act, how to respond, what words to use in American culture, and of course ultimately people do learn at least sufficiently well, and some even better than that to get by. But you know, I suppose that kind of a background was in me to consider the difficulties that she has becoming an artist, becoming a really true artist that is free to create without the cultural restraints under which she has been raised and educated.
So it is more freeing to be in America than the experience at that time of being in Lithuania?
I think it's still more free in America than anywhere in the world.
Hmm. And as an immigrant, as a person who's been other places, it helps you see more clearly.
Yes, and admire it in such a way. I remember this personal incident at one time. We were at some art gathering at dinner, and this relatively, well-off guy was telling me how he's moving somewhere overseas because he doesn't want to pay taxes here. And he earned all his money, of course, here in the United States.
Right.
And it's the most offensive thing that I thought to a person could do, because the man had no understanding how wealthy we all are in the opportunities, even though, frankly, today they're much more difficult because there's so much centralization of both power and money in the United States. But that will change, I think, I hope.
Well, everything changes.
Right.
It's the one constant, right? I love that. The one constant is change. So one of the things that Morning Light definitely delves into, not as its main theme, but it touches on, is what we are dealing with right now on the island and in our state and around the nation. That is, of course, the many mergers that are going on between Catholic church medical systems and their takeover of existing hospitals and other care clinics and whatnot. And it seems that right now, by the end of this year, if the ACLU, I guess, is working very hard on this issue, and they asked Governor Inslee to actually put a moratorium for 6 months on all hospital mergers, which was turned down as a request, although they're looking into the issue. But by the end of this year, we will be at 50% of the hospital beds available in the state of Washington will be under the control of the Catholic Church. And I'm just wondering, since you actually have a much greater depth of understanding of these issues, what that brings up for you, what your thoughts are around that, and
I think autocratic power is dangerous for anyone, anywhere on earth. And I'm not accusing them of doing anything terrible here, but there are faith-based people, and we believe in certain rights, that especially women's health, that the Catholic Church does not believe in, and for them to have the total power over these health issues, It's something that's mistaken. And I think the state actually does have some particular laws that have been passed regarding the performance of hospitals that can eliminate that. Mm-hmm. And I think they can force the hospitals to provide that kind of service. Or I shouldn't say force, that's not what I really mean. I mean somehow to open the doors to what is legally possible in Washington State and what the people of Washington State have voted for.
Right. Yeah, so we've got Emily and Rick, who by marriage in a way agreed to a particular type of life together. They clearly were having sex at the beginning of their marriage, and then things happened, and it's like Rick has made a decision that works for him to do things a certain way. And Emily just doesn't seem to have a voice in that decision. And I just found that really fascinating that, again, you don't dive into them having like a discussion at the beginning. It's not like he came home and said, honey, I'm thinking about doing this. You know, what do you think? It seems like it was a pretty, to use your word, autocratic decision, that was made that she's just having to deal with. And I find that really fascinating. In a marriage, that there could be such a huge change, and it can be created by just one of the two people.
Right. Well, but it's structured. It's described as a crisis in their lives. I mean, she is at an age and a place where she is really exploring and not only exploring, but realizing that maybe she has talent beyond what she previously thought or the people around her believed she had. And he is just came off a very crushing defeat in his life, because he's very practical, he's rational, he's reasonable, and he just went to bankruptcy, and all his reason and practicality, you know, failed to save him. And so he went back to his faith-based roots, so to speak, which Emily has, but hers are light. She's more like 83% of Catholic women in the United States who practice birth control, even though 100% of the bishops oppose it. So, you know, there is just a structural jerry-rigged kind of moral teaching right now in the United States. But that's what creates the tension in that marriage, because the man still loves her, and he says he will not commit this sin because she is committing the sin, and he is culpable if he has sex with her.
Right. It's not even that he's saying, I'm not willing to wear a condom. It's literally, I'm not willing to engage with you if you're doing something.
Exactly.
And that, I think, ties back to what you were saying about that role that historically the Catholic Church has placed upon women. It's like, okay, it's not just, here's what we want to do, how we want to do it, and we advise you to listen and take our advice and hope you'll choose it. You know, in this situation, it's like,
you do it or...
or else.
The rack.
Right, yeah. Well, or in this case, you know, no snuggle time, honey. I mean, that's pretty intense. I mean, I don't know very many marriages that would be able to withstand this. And in your book, there are definitely some fissures and some cracks that appear in this marriage. So it definitely had an impact.
Well, yes. And keeping in mind the history of the Catholic Church, I mean, they did designed the Inquisition, which was a way of discussing issues with people who disagreed with them. Well, they burned them, or they tortured them on a rack or whatever. You know, this is part of the history. Mm-hmm. So, but we don't want to necessarily blame Catholicism. It's just perhaps aggressive human nature. You know, those of us who believe that we are right, we're not going to allow anything or anyone stand in our way. And that's what happens to the husband when he charismatically embraces this extreme right of the Catholic religion. Because again, I don't want to say that every Catholic believes this, because they
don't. No.
So.
Well, I wanted to get the name of this lovely gentleman just about a month and a half ago. I missed it because I was off island. But there is a Catholic bishop, I believe, who has been facing the conflict of being deeply in love with the Catholic religion. I mean, it's his love, one of his two loves, because his other love, I believe, his name is Mark, I believe, is his partner. And he came to the island. I really wanted to be there. You know, I mean, it's like the beauty of humans grappling with contradiction. And that was a really fun part, I think. There was just contradiction all over Morning Light, which is really interesting. But it kept me really pretty riveted in between my children interrupting me for their needs and demands. So I'd written down here that clearly religious beliefs, norms, expectations, and influence continues to shift and change as time passes. So, you know, the Catholic Church during the Inquisition is very different from the Catholic Church right now, thank goodness. So we definitely have seen some evolution in that direction. So what else is it that you would like to bring up about Morning Light, or perhaps talk a little bit about Winter Reads, which came out before Morning Light? Because you don't write a novel without saying something. Your books are not fluff. So would you like to tell us a little bit about Winter Reads?
Well, Winter Reads engages the reader with people who are characters who are driven with certain patterns of belief, but mainly it engages the reader with the authoritarian state. And what do we do if we have a county where the sheriff, who controls all the strings and wishes to keep something very secret in his own past that could affect, you know, the outcome of this investigation into an arson.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was an exploration of both the aggressiveness of government in suppressing information and surveillance, and somebody else who wanted to, again, an artist who wanted to make a film about this arson in which two people died, and mm-hmm. ultimately he discovers that the woman that he has fallen in love with has had a relationship somehow in the past that was unknown to her. And he has a choice of either becoming famous by releasing this film or staying with the woman that he loves. So you'd have to read the novel to
figure that out. You're mean to your characters. they say every good author should be really, really mean to their characters. And I would say you definitely give your characters some tough situations to deal with. So I'm going to have to read that next. It's going to the top of my pile of books to read as soon as we're done with this interview. Okay, well, Holland, this has just been great. Is there any last thing that you'd like to share with us?
No, thank you. It's been such a pleasure talking with you. I'm grateful that you invited me, and wish your listeners great happiness in making sure that no one tells them how to take care of a woman's health other than how would they choose to take care of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So. Thank you also, Holland, for coming over and hanging out while my chickens ran through the kitchen.
I love meeting your chickens, especially that one with gray and black. I mean, it was a gorgeous, stylistic, designed chicken.
They are all so pretty, and so that was very cute. All right. Thank you so much for tuning in to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. My name is March Twisdale, Program Director and Host. If you're joining us now, you've just missed my interview with Holland Kane, author of several books including Morning Light, which touches upon various interesting themes, not the least of which is the impact of the Catholic Church on a young married couple's love life, creating echoes for the larger society as medical facilities around our country fall under the sway of the church, trading hard-fought-for medical freedoms for a bigger pocket to dig into. Clearly a complicated issue. And we're only halfway through. Coming up next today is my interview with Janine Capot-Cruzet, a smart, witty, energetic, and much-beloved writer who is not afraid to point at the white elephants in the room. Born to Cuban immigrants, a lot of her writing explores the Americanization of things, people, traditions, language, and more, making it nearly impossible for her to miss the role of classism and other isms in our society. If you are a first-time listener, welcome. And please know that you can listen to archived shows and learn more about my guest authors by going to our new website at voiceofvashon.org. Then click the On Demand tab, select Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, and you're good to go. If you're a returning listener, welcome back, and thank you for telling your friends about my show. Today, I'm sitting at the Richard Hugo House in Seattle with Janine Capot-Cruzet. Thank you for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you so much for having me, March. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited. So as a quick reminder to our listeners, Prose, Poetry, and Purpose is a new show here at Voice of Vashon with a simple goal of offering authors an opportunity to discuss how they use their art to inspire social change. I find that authors have different ways of looking at that question. Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear, maybe in your words, what your hopes may be when you write a piece about the human experience.
Yeah, I mean, I had a teacher a long time ago, a writer named Elena Miramontes, who used to describe the work of writing as our job being to create and shape a sensory experience that inspires compassion and empathy in others. And that, I mean, she kind of blew me away with the way she sort of described writing as work, a tool for social change. Mm-hmm. And so much so that I wrote that up and in a little, like a little square, and printed it out a million times and put it all over my apartment at the time. Because sometimes I think we, you know, writers are always working in isolation, and we think, what is this going to do? Why am I even doing this? Who's it gonna find someday? And just reading that, the idea that, you know, our job is to create and shape a sensory experience that inspires compassion and empathy in others, mm-hmm. that makes them better people, it makes them better citizens, it makes us more ready and excited to meet each other out in the world as human right. beings. Just knowing that that was my job, no matter what my day job was, that was my real career, helped me sort of move forward and put my first book together and just feel like I was working towards something.
Well, that's awesome. I didn't have that backstory when I first was reading through your collection of short stories.
Correct? Oh, well, it's really private. You guys are getting an exclusive about like what my space looks like where I write. It has like weird things to sort of keep me motivated and keep me going. So that's one of them. This little thing. I have it like inside my planner. I have it inside my wallet.
I love this
little thing that sort of, because you can get really lonely. And you also, you make this thing and you send it out in the world and you really don't know what's going to happen mm-hmm. or how it's going to be interpreted.
Right, exactly.
So, yeah, that's sort of how I think of that question.
I love that. So your first work that's been published is How to Leave Hialeah.
Hialeah.
Yeah.
It's a city.
Right, in?
Miami. It's a neighborhood in Miami. It's predominantly Cuban-American, right. very working class.
Right. Yeah. And so that totally makes, I mean, those, when I read those stories, like each one is a little, it's a vignette of issues that are very specific to that area, that culture, and yet they happen in all cultures.
Yeah, I think it's because in looking at that book, once I had sort of looked at what I had done, I realized that I was writing a lot about class mm-hmm. in American society, which is something we don't talk about often, and then that I think writers are sort of afraid. I don't think writers are afraid, I shouldn't say that. I think Americans are afraid to say that we live in a society with different classes. We don't like to think that. We like to think that everyone can pick themselves up from their bootstraps if they try hard enough. And that was an attitude that I encountered a lot, and that it didn't work for me. It didn't make sense for me and sort of the life I had had and the different insecurities that I still carried with me despite maybe going to college or doing things that helped me jump class, but that I still didn't feel that way. And so mm-hmm. my writing in a lot of ways was trying to work through those questions for myself in the hopes that someone would find it and have those experiences reflected. And I felt like a lot of times that experience of sort of working class or lower class people isn't necessarily reflected in what we call literature. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to sort of give voice to the voiceless with my
or
work.
Or even like television.
Oh, yeah.
You know? I mean, The Cosby Show, really? I mean, yeah. Like how many people actually had that type
yeah.
of life?
Yeah, and there's a specific narrative that goes, you know, if we're hearing about working class, there's always a specific sort of narrative or archetype that follows that. And so I wanted in my work, I try to make room for more voices
right.
that way and expand that as best as possible.
Right.
Well,
now I'm understanding why I enjoyed How to Leave Hialeah so much. Like, okay, I mean, yeah, because absolutely you nailed your goals entirely. So the theme of classism came up a whole bunch for you in that one. Mm-hmm. So real quick, as a reminder to our listeners, if you're tuning in, you're listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose on Voice of Vashon at voiceofvashon.org. My name is Marge Swisdale. I'm talking today with Janine Capo-Crucet, author of How to Leave Hialeah, a collection of short stories. Now, you won an award.
The book did. I mean,
yeah,
I feel like
yeah.
I guess I get to hold it and keep it in my house, but it's very, you know, it was for the book.
And the award is?
The book itself won the Iowa Short Fiction Prize.
Right.
And so that's sort of what allowed it to come out into the world, sort of. And then after mm-hmm. that, it won the John Gardner Book Award and the Devil's mm-hmm. Kitchen Prize in Poetry, which is really cool because that's elected through a student body that reads a bunch of books, and then they pick the book they're most excited about, and they bring that author to campus. And it's actually been picked as a freshman read at a couple schools, which, I mean, it's reached
great.
Much more people than I thought it ever would. You know, you write these things, again, like alone
right.
in your house, and you
yeah.
think, oh, it's okay if no one ever reads this. It's just for me. I'm saying what I need to say, and you hope it finds an audience. But yeah, it's done well. And the title story, which is actually the one that's sort of the most gritty, I think, in terms of approaching some of these different issues mm-hmm. that we're talking about. That one went on to win a Penn O'Henry Prize and was anthologized in the Penn O'Henry collection, which was huge because that was the story that I probably was like, my heart was the most, I mean, my heart's in all of them, but that's the one that I felt like was sort of laid bare the most.
Right.
And so to see it find a much wider audience thanks to that anthology is really cool.
Well, I'm so happy for you.
Thank you. Yay. Yeah, yeah. It still feels very unreal.
It's so cool. So I guess you've sort of already answered this question, which was that the premise of prose poetry and purpose is that true, deep change seems to come most frequently through the heart.
Oh, absolutely.
Rather than up here inside our head with all sorts of talking stuff going on. Mm-hmm. And the idea being that, as you said, this woman had suggested the experiential sensory moment. You know, until we experience life in another person's shoes, we can't really understand their perspective, even if we think up here that we do have the statistics and all that. So as a writer with a message, you know, so what do you hope your readers might take away from your stories?
Oh, I think there's it's weird. I think there's a difference from what they take away versus what I hope they take away in some ways. But I think the idea of expanding their imaginations and expanding their hearts to have room for people they might not know or not encounter, and that there's nothing like reading a novel or even a short story. It's really the closest you can ever be to another person, right? Mm-hmm. It is a character, but it's another person. It's a truth. It's a lie that tells the truth, right? At least in fiction. And you really can never be that close to someone else's mind as you can a character that you know. Like, we know some of these characters more than we know, you know, our partners in our lives mm-hmm. or, you know, the people that we love or our families. So what I hope people take away from my work is that they sort of feel compassion for the characters they're learning about and that they're experiencing in different ways, and that their hearts just sort of open up and make room for that, for people they might not know. Especially for me, coming from a Cuban background and a Cuban American background, I'm hoping to reach people that might never meet anyone from Hialeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, I don't think of the book as edutainment. Like, I don't want someone to be like, okay, now I know everything I need to know about the Cuban American community. But to understand just how big the world is and how important it is that we are sort of ready to encounter anyone with it. And I think every time you read something that is trying to create and shape that sensory experience, it's doing that. It's expanding your heart that way.
Which is sort of the opposite of a lot of what comes down from mainstream media, which is let's minimize, let's simplify, let's, you know, make this a very, you know, right and wrong.
Right.
Oh, they're all bad, we're all good. Or, you know, anyone who looks like that is probably like this. Mm. There's so many profiling messages that we're inundated with.
Well,
and then you're in a way sort of like, you have the time, the breadth, and the space on those pages to take a person who someone might walk by and just glance at them in a grocery store and have these preconceptions jump up, and you're able to like take them on a little trip through that person's life and have them come out the other end thinking, oh wow, that's totally different than I thought.
Yeah, well, and I think too, you're in describing sort of the goals of that sort of mass market stuff. I mean, we're using the word market. It's to make money. It's profit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think anyone who's, I mean, no one should go into writing to make money because that's never a guarantee. But I think it matters when you're creating something what your motivations are. And so when I lived in Los Angeles for a little while, and so I was, it was weird. I worked for this amazing nonprofit organization, and during the day we were in South Central Los Angeles, Compton, downtown LA. And in the evenings, there were donors that were all like the Beverly Hills and the Bel Air, and it was in the Pacific Palisades, and it was like two completely different LAs, which it is.
Mm-hmm.
But in being somewhat exposed to Hollywood, their goals are to make money. They're not trying to necessarily make art all the time. That's not the primary consideration. They would, if art gets made, cool. But they also gotta clear, you know, they gotta like make their budget and make a certain amount back. Same thing with television. They need to make sure they're having advertisers, and literature in some ways is still somewhat immune from that. A little bit. I mean, there's still some of that coming in, but for the most part, it's actually a more democratic, you know, lowercase d, mm-hmm. democratic medium in that way. And I mean, the short story specifically is something that it's incredibly democratic, and it's something that everyone has access to it, right. both the creation and the appreciation of it.
Right, right. As well, especially, you know, with libraries and schools.
Right.
And, you know, and it is a good point. It's like, you know, a person can go out there and say, you know, I'm going to go ahead and put myself at risk for, you know, $5,000 and self-publish myself, blah, blah, blah. Mm. Whereas a studio in Hollywood is like, oh, $300,000 or $300 million or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
small budget Hollywood things are still so much money.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was completely broke and working at an after-school daycare and working and writing a book, you know? So
right.
I wouldn't have been able to make a movie that way. I mean, maybe somebody, I think now with the advent of things like YouTube and there's more access and it's becoming a more democratic form, but not yet. Not the way writing is,
yeah.
I think.
Right. Oh, okay. This is so cool. I love where you're taking us in this interview. This is great. So I do remember reading about your work with teens in mm-hmm. California.
Yes, in Los Angeles, yeah.
And just this summer you were teaching a special class geared towards teens at the 2013 Port Townsend Writers Conference.
Mm-hmm.
And it went well.
Oh, it totally rebooted my heart for another year.
Yay! Okay, I figured it would.
I think they enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. So
yeah.
Hopefully that percolated out.
Yeah,
I had a blast.
I remember you said you were a little nervous going into it, and I thought, they're going to love her. So I would like to hear your thoughts on how you see today's teens, dealing with the complicated world that they're entering, just from your experience. And also, do you have any words of encouragement for young people who may be feeling a bit overwhelmed?
Yeah.
That's sort of like two questions, but, you know, definitely, what are you seeing with teens? Because what they're facing and what I was facing, mm-hmm. you know, 20 years ago, well, 25 years ago, very different,
yeah.
you know?
You know, my students at Port Townsend actually asked me the same thing. I said, give us some phrase, and you know, as vulgar as it might sound, I just said, make sure that you're using a condom. Because I feel like you have to have a very concrete, practical advice.
Right.
And that, you know, the idea of protecting yourself when you're sexually active.
Well, you made the comment earlier about how Americans are very uncomfortable talking about classism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like right over there in India, they have a caste system, but mm-hmm. we don't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that type of, you know, myth believing that mm-hmm. we have. And right now, you know, you're talking about something that that people are sometimes uncomfortable with, but it's like so important to talk about it. And in a way, this is reminding me of the one story, one of the stories in your collection, the young woman who she and her mother are driving in the car because mom and dad don't quite realize just how bad the boyfriend is, and she's like going to take mom to come see the boyfriend
who's
going up to some house and cheating on her, yada yada.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to give any more away, but the mom's reaction just had me like,
yeah,
I adored it. But, you know, it's like that was a moment where, you know, we like to try to shield or hide mm-hmm. or avoid, and yet it just prolongs sort of or creates more problems.
Right.
And then when she finally faced it, her parents were like there for her,
mm-hmm.
and now she can move forward. And I think at the end of the story, there's been definitely a moving forward.
I hope so. I mean,
in that, if I'm remembering it correctly, which I think I am.
Yeah.
So
that story.
Yeah,
that,
we have to face reality if we want to deal with it.
Yeah. That story it's called Men Who Punched Me in the Face. And part of what inspired writing it was that I was sitting in a feminist studies course in college, mm-hmm. and there was a lot of conversation about how whenever there's domestic violence, you must leave. You cannot make room for this. The first time someone hits you, you must go. And I was coming from a background or from a, you know, an experience that seemed like a very privileged attitude. You had to be able to afford to leave. You had to be able to have somewhere to go. You couldn't be depending on this person for any sort of support. Yeah, what are you doing with your kids? What if you... And I mean, I knew people that if they left, they would get grief from their families for leaving. And, you know, you made a commitment before God to be with this person, and you can't leave just because now you've picked wrong. And so I remember sitting in that class and trying to explain that, well, what about this and what about this, bringing up these options or, you know, these scenarios. And just hearing from the women around me, no, like there is no excuse, you must go. And I was like, I just feel like there's some idea of their experience is limited here and my experience is limited as well, and we need some way to talk to each other. And so part of why that story came into being was just that. I was like, I have to get, this woman's voice came into my head, the narrator's voice just came into my head, and I actually wrote the whole story. I had 102 fever. I had no insurance at the time, and I was just like, well, let's see, if I die, this will be the last thing that I do. And I wrote it in one shot. I mean, I obviously revised it, but the whole thing was in one sitting of like several hours, and I just felt like this is me giving her space. And I sort of wrote it for those women in that class in a way to find it, encounter it, believe her, and understand why sometimes people stay, why they feel like they have to stay or why they feel forced to stay, and why it's not so easy to just, you know, even though you might know that's the right thing to do, it's not always right for each person. And that's a really ugly thing to think about, but it's the reality for a lot of people.
Or at the moment. I mean, it's really, really neat how you sort of bring up the element of privilege, because, you know, if we go back 100 years to, you know, when The Jungle was written by Sinclair, I believe.
Sinclair.
Okay. You know, it's like, really? Did those women have the opportunity to just like, oh, you just slapped me, honey. I'm out of here with my 5 kids in the middle of, you know, some tenement apartment, and, you know, there's nowhere to go, and I'll, you know, life will get worse, actually.
Right.
So, and I think that what sounds like what you were maybe responding to was the sense of judgment people can have sometimes on a person who they don't think they're doing the right thing.
Yeah. I think was that this woman didn't exist for the other people in that class. And it was so, like, I didn't know how you could just leave. It seemed very irresponsible to just leave when you have to sort of make it work. And that was the wrong attitude to have, but it was also, theirs was too, in a way, you know? And that's but I know her very well, you know? Like, she lives inside of my imagination, and I can conjure that. Mm-hmm. And it's my responsibility to put that out there.
Right.
So that's sort of where it's making a space for her.
And yet with her eventually getting the help she needed, the support, the opportunity, and leaving. Mm-hmm. So you created space for respecting the process she went through.
Yeah. Well, the process is definitely there. I don't know at the end of that story how much better off she is. But I think that's up to the reader to interpret. And, you know, I won't.
And see, to me, when your parents who didn't understand, and one of the big things about domestic abuse is that they'll be so nice to everybody else that everyone else just thinks they're awesome, and then you can't say anything. And the mom and dad seem to have thought he was really awesome.
Yeah.
And now they know, so now she has, my impression from the way it was written, or the way I read it, was that now she has allies who are completely instantaneously on her side. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, you know, like the way the mom treats the guy. I love that. You know, she's like, that's it. Bam. Yeah. You know, loyalty to my daughter, you know, first. Yeah. So one last question about the teens in particular at the conference. A term that I've actually coined in the last couple of months is ACTopian.
Whoa.
It's a genre. Mm-hmm. You have dystopian and you have utopian. Mm-hmm. And both of those are typically very fantastical, futuristic scenarios that are pretty extremely different from the current modern day.
Right.
So they're used to illustrate how bad it could get, how good it could get, but they're not really reachable. You know, they're not plausible. And ACTopian fiction is sort of like activism creating in the current day a fictional storyline that's plausible, that illustrates actions taken by characters that actually have generally a positive impact, that a reader at the end of the book might say, you know, that's actually something I could do.
Right.
And so I'm curious if how many teens you've been working with that are dealing with literature, if some of them are also doing sort of what you're doing, which is seeing literature as a way of writing out ideas of how things could be better. It seems that humans are very, very good at like fables and moralistic tales of what not to do. You know, if you do this, this bad thing will happen. You know, Red Riding Hood, whatever.
Right.
It's not that often that we actually read a story that puts out a suggestion for what to do to make things better. It's usually cautionary tales.
Right.
And with ACTopian fiction, I'm hoping to I would like to see more people putting their neck on the line in a way, sticking their neck out, and Have you encountered many of the young people who are like coming up with ideas? You know, what if we did this or what if we did that? I'm just wondering if that's sort of out there.
I think beginning writers, and when I mean beginning, I mean just young people that are just beginning, mm-hmm. are very much still trying to figure out what's important to them. Mm-hmm. And so, for instance, at the Port Townsend Writers Conference, the first thing we did was a very extensive free write about what obsesses you. And I think so much of the beginning of your time as a writer is just figuring out what obsesses you. And
right.
they're still
yeah.
trying to figure yeah. it out, who it is they are and if they have something
right.
to sort of offer.
I'm just so glad you chose to come spend your summer here in the Northwest.
I feel very lucky to be here. Yeah.
Yeah. Take a break from the beautiful weather in Florida.
No, not right now.
No,
it's brutal there in the summer.
Okay.
It's brutal there in general. I mean, I grew up in South Florida, but I'm living in northern Florida now where I teach, and so
we have like our snowbirds that leave in the winter and you have summer birds that leave in the summer.
I think it might just be us. We might be the yeah. I got very lucky. My spouse is doing a clerkship at Earth Justice. And so he's one of the good guys. He's studying to be an environmental lawyer, and he's one
Beautiful.
Of the good guys, like working very, yeah. very hard to help protect our natural resources. So he's a,
right.
he's a good guy. And him being here has afforded me the opportunity to be here teaching at Hugo House and finishing
great.
Up a new book out here. So,
yeah.
and to meet you and get to do this interview. So it's
yeah.
been really sweet to be out here.
Yeah. So, for our listeners, this has been great. I've been talking with Janine Capocruset. Thank you, Janine.
Thank you, March. This has been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been awesome.
Like the wild horse runs in the mountains, like the sun sets beyond the sea. Like the wind blows through the trees on a crisp autumn evening while I've been free. It can't be caught, it can't be tamed, it cannot be held still. It can't be touched, it can't be felt, it can't be stolen away. Run free and be who you were made to be. In the clouds above, like the bird soars in the endless sky, like the thunder that rolls out of sight on every